great one for you this evening. We have Kevin Day. We're going to be talking in depth about the USS Nimitz case back in 2004. We'll get into his background a little bit later. And I do want to thank everyone that helps support the show. Anyone can do that. That's on podcastufo.com. I also want to thank the people that help out with the show. And also, speaking of that, helping out, every week now we have a new blog over at podcastufo.com. Charles Lear is writing blogs for us. He has sort of a skeptical attitude in his blogs, getting a little bit of feedback, a lot of positive feedback, too. So check out those stories on the website. I think we have four of them so far in the last 4 weeks. And I think that is going to be about it. I'm back in my own home studio, and it feels great with all the equipment here. Hopefully there won't be any failures. We had a little bit of technical difficulty trying to get our guest rolling this evening, but he says it seems to be happening to him, almost like he's targeted, but I don't want to start any rumors or anything. But it'll be interesting to see if we can make it all the way through the show. Hopefully his phone is good and charged and we're ready to go. Alejandro, welcome to the show.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah. I saw your Facebook postings this weekend. Looks like you were having a blast. Let's talk about what you were doing.
Yeah. In fact, the news that I'll be talking about is related to it, because one of the big pieces of news is that, the History Channel is going to be doing a show. Essentially, it's related to the Stars Academy, but also ATIP, the program, of course, that Lou Elizondo ran. And I'll talk more about what Lou shared this weekend, because he was there at this event that you alluded to, the Anomalous Aerospace Phenomena Conference, which was hosted by the Scientific Coalition for Ufology, something I've been with since the beginning. And, of course, you've had Robert Powell. I think you've had Morgan Biel and Rich Hoffman, some of the other people.
Rich, yeah.
In particular, you've had Robert lately on the Nimitz case. So one of the things and one of the highlights of the programming was Robert Powell with Peter Reale going over their findings and their investigation of the Nimitz case. So that was really interesting, especially in the calculations of the speed. The case is extraordinary. Of course, we've spent a lot of time talking about it. Your guest, you're going to be talking about it with him. But the speeds that they estimated this thing traveling at, and the power consumption, or the power that exhibited by the craft with their estimations, are huge. So thousands of miles an hour. They estimate the thing, likely had, if it were a solid object moving at these accelerations that were observed, the G forces were huge, at least somewhere in the order of hundreds of G forces, and then hundreds of Gs, and just for so people know, like Gs, typically an air fighter pilot will experience up to 9 Gs. An aircraft can only take a little more than that before it starts falling apart. Now, at times, for quick times, they can experience maybe 16 Gs, but this is for a small period of time. And experiencing that much G forces over an extended period of time could kill you. The most any humans ever experience is in the range of 40 Gs. A doctor, a scientist, was using himself as a guinea pig, and it was for a split second, and he broke bones and had major issues. So the G forces that would have been necessary for what was observed in the Nimitz incident are at in the order of hundreds of Gs, if not thousands. So certainly something that not only humans couldn't resist, but also any mechanical devices, aircraft we have, also wouldn't be able to take those G forces. So really cool stuff that they did there.
I just want to mention this while we're on this topic. And that is, there were also speeds at high altitude of very slow speeds of, I think, 100 miles an hour or 100 knots or below.
Oh, which it was is observed.
Not sustainable.
Sitting at a standstill.
Yeah, that's even more spectacular.
Uh-huh. So, yeah. just not sitting still completely. So yeah, really cool analysis. That report I know will be coming out in the next couple of weeks for everybody to see, and hopefully it won't be too long till we're able to also get something together where that PowerPoint and kind of the summary of the analysis will be able to put up on an SCU webpage or YouTube page as well. So yeah, that was really exciting. Another piece of news out there, you'll see an article on the Daily Express. It's titled, UFO Sightings, NASA Expert Urges to Take Alien Claims Seriously. There Must Be Life. And this is an article that came out before the conference, but it was an interview with one of the other presenters, and that was Dr. Kevin Knuth. He's an associate professor in Albany. At SUNY, actually, and he teaches space, and he's worked for NASA for a period of time. His talk was extremely interesting in that he was going over, when you're dealing with speeds that are close to the speed of light, or even a fraction up to over 0.25 the speed of light, then there are now time anomalies. So the people traveling at that speed are experiencing time different than the people who aren't traveling at those speeds. That's important for perspective. So, for example, he talks about how, a lot of the questions we have could be related to just major perceptions, differences in the perception of time. So, for instance, if we saw a craft, and people have talked about how the craft that we're seeing 50 years ago are very similar today, aren't they advancing? Well, his point is that, depending on where they're traveling and how, we could be seeing, a craft 50 years later, but the perception of the person traveling in that craft is that it only maybe a day or less has passed. Talks about, right. That could be the same craft. And also, if that's the case, let's say every time they come back here, 50 years has passed to us, whereas it's been only a smaller amount of time to them, they wouldn't want to interact because, it would be useless. With that major difference in time, you couldn't have a conversation, and our culture is going to be very different. So a lot of really interesting things. In fact, his talk was a lot more fun and intricate than that, but hopefully we'll see that soon as well. But what was really exciting, last week we had this announcement of the History Channel show called Unidentified that will be about real investigations related to the stars. And what Lou Elizondo told us while he was there speaking is that, a lot of these cases he refers to, he often tells us there's more than just a Nimitz case, even though we've only heard from witnesses or even reports related to Nimitz, that there are other cases that he can't share details or information about. Well, this History Channel show is going to be sharing that information. So more of these cases, some of which he says are even more extraordinary than Nimitz, which is hard to wrap your head around because it was such an extraordinary case. But there are other witnesses. So, of course, we've heard from great witnesses, Kevin, who you're having on, David Fravor, some others. But we're going to also hear from witnesses related to more military cases that were covered. Like I said, some of which Elizondo says are better than the Nimitz case.
Right. The one off of Florida, for instance, was a pretty big case. It'd be great mm-hmm. to hear from them. But, I'm just wondering what the film footage is out there that, has not been seen. That's mm-hmm. It must be really amazing what Lou actually knows, that he can't come out with. I'd love to know what's in his brain.
Yeah, I know. And, he's excited to share. And he made this emphasis, it's something that he said all along is that he's a patriot.
Yeah.
While he does agree more information about this should come out. And, really, if it wasn't for him coming out and telling us about ATIP, we probably still would not know about it. So he even left and came out and talked about it. However, one of the questions I asked, actually, does he consider himself a whistleblower? He says no, because although he's kind of straddling a gray line, he says a whistleblower is someone who sees something going on that shouldn't be going on and comes out and talks about it, even if it's classified. And he's not doing that. He's not sharing classified information. However, he felt this information that was, you know, being collected by his group should be coming out and getting to his superiors, but it wasn't. And that's why he resigned and now is sharing what he can of this information to the, you know, even though it many people that are still on the inside did not want him to share this information. And we now have heard that at the beginning, when he shared this information, there were more people that were upset. Now people have become a little upset, but the progress that they've made is huge. And of course, the television show shooting of that, we haven't been able to see a lot of that. And a lot of the progress they have made, for instance, with working with the government and politicians, we haven't been able to see a lot of that. I know Kevin has shared some of that information, and you all will be able to talk about that. But there's been a lot more attention, incredible attention to this topic, which is really exciting. And in fact, you know, the SCU event was held near the Redstone Arsenal, near the Rocket Center. This is the area in Alabama, Huntsville, Alabama, where there's Project Paperclip. A German scientist came after World War II, began, the U.S. missile and rocketry programs, gave him a kickstart, and NASA was began here. So this is kind of where this all began, and there were a lot of scientists in the area that are interested in the topic, but they want to hear more credible information. So having these PhDs and Lou Elizondo there in the area brought out some of the scientists that are interested who still want to kind of not necessarily share their interests for fear of ridicule. And Kevin can talk about some of the ridicule I know they faced when they had their sighting, even by, you know, fellow military men. But it's just brought this level of credibility, and it provided for this incredible environment that we had this weekend, where it was all very serious. It was very science-based. It was academic. A plethora of PhDs there to discuss at a very high level the different possibilities of what could be going on here, and evidence that we have related to this phenomena. So yeah, it was an extraordinary weekend.
Wow, great. Well, Alejandro, I'm glad you're back, and thanks so much for coming on and getting us up to date, and we'll be talking to you next week.
My pleasure. Talk to you next week.
All right, have a good one.
You too.
Thanks a lot. All right. So our guest, well, first of all, I want to say a little shout out to Lisa. She's brand new to the show. And there's many, many people I should be giving a shout out to, all the people that help out with the show. And if you'd like me to give you a shout out and you help out with the show, please do. Email me at martin@podcastufo.com. I'd be glad to. So anyway, our guest, Kevin Day, he is a retired United States Navy Senior Chief Petty Officer, a former Operations Specialist and Top Gun Air Intercept Controller with more than 20 years experience in strike group air defense, including wartime operations, an expert operator of the highly advanced SPY-1 radar system, which is top-notch. They don't get any better than that, with years of service on board the Aegis-equipped ships, including the USS Vincennes, I'm probably getting that wrong, USS Chosen, and the Princeton, where this story begins. And we're going to be talking to him now. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Well, thanks for having me. Very glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry we couldn't get you on Skype. Boy, we sure tried hard, though, didn't we?
We did. We gave it a run. I'm not sure what's going on with my Skype connection or my internet in general, for that matter.
Right. I think that was
kind of strange.
I think we gave that a full hour try. That's enough. So here you are on the phone. I'm sorry you're not on video, but you're on the phone, and it's a real pleasure to have you on.
It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I think you and I first connected. I was looking at email and stuff. I think you and I first connected all the way back last June. You perhaps listened to a show I did with Robert Powell. I'm not really sure how that all came together. Can you? I do want to go over the incident in general, but I want to also go over when you decided to actually come out and talk about this.
Well, this whole year has been quite a whirlwind for me. I was actually waiting tables down at our local golf course for free because I've been trying to help save it from bankruptcy, and which we have, by the way, which is a great news story. And I saw the CNN story break on CNN about Commander Fravor coming out about the UFO incident. And I basically dropped everything I was doing at that moment. I was in shock, and I was awed that this was happening. And I knew instantly right then I had to back up. I had to back up my former colleague and shipmate, because you know this incident really did happen, and it's kind of a strange situation because when it happens to you, the people that you think are going to believe you don't necessarily really believe you. And so you kind of tend to maybe not talk about it. And that's kind of what happened to me for years and years and years.
Wow. Yeah, that's so
that was,
hurtful.
Just over a year ago now. And so I started reaching out, you know, I contacted Robert Powell and he contacted me right away. And I joined a group on Facebook. It's a private closed group called ATIP, Sigma's a Pentagon program. And one thing led to another. I started reaching out to some of my former shipmates, and the whole thing just kind of snowballed, and it kind of arrived. You know, brings us up to date on that.
Well, yes, and I should say, because of some people got my newsletter out there, that we were going to have three guests: you, Jason Turner, and David Beatty. But that just didn't work out. David is at a conference and couldn't make it, and Jason just couldn't be on the show, I guess. So it's too bad, but I'm really glad that you hung in there and here you are. So I do appreciate that.
I just think it's important. I want to do more and more shows like this because I got to tell you, Martin, my personal goal out of this, I want the truth to come out. And what I really want to do is I want to get a group of us together that were there that witnessed this thing. And I want to go tell Congress about it. I want to talk about it, and I want them to know that it really did happen. They were real objects. They appeared to be aware, and they appeared to be prescient. And the flight characteristics can only really be described as non-Newtonian. What we saw was completely fascinating, you know. And I don't know what they were, but I can tell you that I know what they weren't.
Yeah, I'm glad you say it that way, you know, and you and I have talked briefly, and I like your skeptical attitude. I think it's very important. And you basically told me you have no use for people that are pseudo skeptics as well. You know, the people that just plain shake their finger at it, said, no way this can happen, you know, and by, you know, claiming this or that. So we will talk about what the skeptics have said and address that a little bit later on. But there are a lot of new listeners, and I'd like for you to kind of lay down the scene of what happened, you know, just in a nutshell, more or less, for the, like I said, for the new listener, and what happened, then we'll go into what your involvement in it.
It was 2004. It occurred off the coast of San Diego. The Nimitz Strike Group was out to sea. We were doing a tailored ship training availability. And unfortunately, not all the ships could be out there. We, you know, the war was still going on, so we had received orders to accelerate and go overseas, so we were trying to get a lot of training done really quickly. At any rate, we were out to sea with the Nimitz. We were going to do an ADEX, and on board the Nimitz, we had CAG 11, VAW 117, and CAG 11 was a commander of all the fighter squadrons. And I'd been seeing these anomalous contacts on my scope for, I don't know, a few days. We were going to do the ADEX on the 14th, and around about the 10th, the team in CIC in Princeton started noticing these contacts. And we were off the coast of San Diego, kind of southwest, about 100 miles or so. I forget exactly how far it was that day. And these objects, whatever they were coming into our radar envelope right in the Channel Islands, right there by Catalina. And they were appearing on the scope anywhere from like between 5 and 10 at a time. And the odd thing about it is they were at 28,000 feet going 100 knots tracking south, which was really weird. Now,
yeah, I mean, it's something would just fall out of the sky at that normally, right? I mean, there's no way it could maintain.
Plummet straight out of the sky, especially when the you know, the prevailing winds are going from west to east, so they're going counter to the prevailing winds. We didn't really, no one really felt they were a threat because they were just there. And, you know, the strike group was quite a few miles away from them. We just didn't get the impression they were any type of threat, although we were using all of our electronic systems aboard the ships. We really had no ID for them. So the day of the Agdex comes up, and up to this point, I'd probably seen, I don't know, 80 or 90 of these things up to that moment. And Captain Smith comes down to combat and says, "Sir, you know, we've been tracking these things for a while, and I'm not really concerned they're hostile or malevolent in any way, but I am concerned about safety of flight because we're getting ready to launch a bunch of aircraft right in this altitude space. And if we run into one of these things, someone's going to ask us, you know, later, why didn't we do something about it?" So I said, "You know what, Senior Chief is right. Go ahead and take the flight that's airborne right now. They're up doing a functional flight check and go see what it is. Go intercept it." And in the back of my mind, I'm saying, "Heck yeah, I'm going to intercept. I'm going to get to intercept an anomalous object," which was kind of my goal. Because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, this is so strange that this is definitely something that I've never seen before. So anyway, we take control of the Fast Eagle flight, which just happens to have been Commander Fravor's flight. And we start vectoring in that direction. And we just picked the closest object, and we vectored him up towards there. And as soon as he gets to the merge plot position, he starts screaming on the radio. We had the comms on the overhead in Combat Information Center, CIC, on the ship. And he starts screaming, "Oh, my God, oh, my God, I'm engaged. And from that moment, all hell broke loose. This object that he had intercepted dropped from 28,000 feet down to the surface of the ocean, and what I found out the next day was 0.78 seconds.
Wow. And what's the speed? What's the speed on that?
You know what? That was covered at SCU, and I hesitate to even say anything because I've heard all kinds of numbers, and I just don't want to put out any erroneous numbers out there.
Yeah, no problem.
But it's extremely fast. We should have heard multiple sonic booms.
Right.
There was no sonic booms at all. All of a sudden, it was at 28,000 feet. Less than a second later, it was down at the surface of the water.
You know, I got to tell you, just to interject a little bit, I have never once heard of anyone one time talking about a sonic boom in a UFO. And they have been, there's many, many cases where they've been tracked at very high speeds, you know, up into the 20,000 miles an hour, you know, type of thing. But no one has ever once mentioned a sonic boom, which is really bizarre, isn't it?
It is very bizarre, and it's one of the reasons why I believe they're a non-Newtonian. There's other reasons as well. So he leads his wingman, the second aircraft that's with him, up kind of a higher altitude. He wants to go down and take a look. So he goes down and tracks this thing down to the surface and sees a disturbance in the water that everyone's been talking about. And right above this disturbance, he sees a little tiny object. And he described it when we came back into port a week later or so. It looked like a tiny tic-tac, about 47 feet long, about the length of a Super Hornet, F-18 Super Hornet. And this thing came popped right back out of the ocean. I don't think it was actually in the ocean, it was right above the surface, back up to 28,000 feet. Started going 100 knots again, tracking south, as if nothing at all interesting had just happened.
Interesting, wow.
And then you know, and the thing is, we got all these other aircraft launching off the deck of the Nimitz, and they're all up doing their functional flight checks. Well, everybody's listening to the radios, everybody's up in the data links, and everybody's got situational awareness now about what's going on out here. So I got a bunch of other aircraft taking off now, and they're all doing their own intercepts autonomously with no air controller. And next thing I know, I got all these UAP, I call them UFOs then, because I didn't even know what a UAP was at the time. But these things are all falling out of the sky from 28,000 feet down to the surface of the ocean in less than a second. It was actually raining UFOs for a brief moment on the radar.
Amazing.
Totally, totally unbelievable. I mean, you should have seen and felt the shocked silence that was in combat, because, you know, a team like ours, the government spends millions of dollars training us. Training us to ID everything that flies, and right. None of us had any idea what these objects were. We, and to this day, we still don't know.
Yeah, Yeah, amazing. Well, we are right at the break, so we're going to head into a break here. Hang in there, everyone. We'll be right back right after these messages. Hello and welcome back to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have Kevin Day. He is talking about the USS Nimitz case, which happened back in 2004. Great guest, great topic, as far as I'm concerned. And Kevin, thanks so much. So can you continue talking about, you were talking about David Fravor and his interceptor. What was it you actually mentioned?
He was his name of his flight was Fast Eagle Flight. It was a Super Hornet, FNA-18. Mm-hmm. I believe it was a brand new airplane that he was flying that day, what I heard. At any rate, just to kind of pick up the story, he consummated the intercept and the thing avoided and went back up into the sky. So he goes back up in the sky, and then the next thing that we know, this object that he had tried to intercept, all of a sudden, it went from point A to point B in about 40 miles, in less than a second. What it did is we have what's known as combat air patrol stations. They're basically just arbitrary altitudes and positions in the sky around the strike group where the fighters kind of hang out. That's their hangout spot until they get orders or vectors to do something. And that's a socialized point that everyone in the strike group knows about, and we give them names. This object, for whatever reason, went to that point in the sky and just sat there. It went to his cap station. It went to the spot where he was intending to go. It was kind of prescient, I guess. Never forget that. The air controller's like, I was the air control supervisor. Had the junior guy there was actually talking to him, and I was listening. I was helping with the external comms, and I was trying to help him assess the radar and all that stuff. And I'll never forget, he was like, sir, you're not going to believe this, but the bogey is back at your cap station.
Now, can you explain the significance?
On the radio after that.
Can you explain the significance of this? I mean, how would the thing even know, how would any intelligence even know where that location is?
Well, I mean, presumably anyone in receipt of our message traffic would know where this place was in the sky. Secret message traffic. But this object wasn't a part of our strat group. This object, as far as I know, wasn't a part of the exercise. And that's a really darn good question. How, in fact, did the object know where that point in the sky was?
That is really something, isn't it?
Wow. And I don't have an answer. That's part of the part of the puzzle here. And I've always had the frame of mind that I'm going to really refrain from speculating about what those things were, because I really don't think that's my role. There's lots more qualified people than me to do that. I'm just here to tell folks that this thing really did happen. These objects really were really real. And there just wasn't one. There was over 100 of them. Right around 100 of them. And I tracked them for a little over a week on the radar. Not only me, but other ships too, other aircraft.
Now,
lots of witnesses.
So were you in constant contact with the other ships to see if they were actually seeing this as well at the same time?
I remember now this part is actually kind of odd. You know, it's been 14 years ago and people's memories do odd things.
Yeah.
I could give you plenty of examples of that. Now, I retired in 2008, and this story kind of bugged me. This was 4 years later. I retired, and so I wrote a short story called The Seer, and I wrote it with a couple other short stories, and I put it in a book that I hand published, and I published it in the Library of Congress. And I was thinking at the time, well, no one's going to believe me, so I'm just going to write this story. I'll put it in plain sight. In case this story ever does come to light, it can kind of be some evidence. Well, strangely enough, that's happened now. The serendipity with this thing, and there's a lot of tentacles to this story. Now, I'm sorry, what was your question? I kind of lost my train of thought there.
me too. I'm digging through all types of things on this side here, trying to arrange the next question.
I know, and I was trying to complete my story of the intercept that happened. And I guess that pretty much summarizes it. You had some questions about it. So, you know, that day I'm guessing there was probably, interestingly enough, the At FLIR video that's out there that was released when the New York Times story broke.
Right.
They released a couple of videos with it. That video that was actually taken, called At FLIR, that was actually not Commander Fravor's flight. That was one of the other aircraft that went up and did another intercept.
Yeah, but the one I'm putting up on the screen now is the one that was separate, the Tic Tac one that's up on the YouTube screen right now for people over there watching that. So I made sure that I got the right one up. And it's fuzzy at first, and then it shows very clear Tic Tac shape, which is fascinating. And what I had asked you, I believe what I asked you was if you were in contact with other ships at the same time about, you know, what they were seeing on radar. I think that was the question I asked you.
Yeah, good point. Anyway, my story I'd written at the time, that the name of the exercise, and, you know, I purposely fictionalized my story because it was only 4 years later. And I was thinking, you know, I better protect the people still in uniform. Maybe they don't want to talk about this, and maybe they can't talk about it. So I kind of fictionalized the actual story a little bit. So, and I changed some of the names and some of the dates and stuff. And one of the things that I think I had done at the time, and now my memory's not real clear on this, is I thought our entire strike group was out to sea that day with us. And as it turns out, they actually weren't. The Chafee and Higgins were, Chafee was underway, just coming out of Hawaii, and Higgins was actually in port. Now, the reason why I believe they may have been there with us, because there's a system called Battle Force Tactical Trainer, BFIT, and it was possible they could have been up in BFIT, basically participating, getting ready to participate in the ADEX remotely, which they could have done. They could have received synthetic training videos, and they would have had all the comms, and their weapon systems could have been stimulated as well. So that is perhaps why I had the memory of the other ships being out there. But yes, I did. I emailed my friend over on the Nimitz, got an email back saying, yeah, we see the objects, don't know what the hell they are. They were up in a system called CEC, which is a cooperative engagement capability, which basically fuses all the radar inputs into one presentation and shares it back across the strike group. We ran extensive diagnostics on the Spy One radar system and the combat weapon system on board Princeton, just to make sure that, hey, is this some sort of malfunction? What are we seeing here? And we were unable to detect any type of malfunction. All of us came away believing that whatever they were real. The objects were actually there, and they were real.
Wow. Now, what's the plane that flies above there with the big radar dish on it, 24-foot dish, the Skyhawk?
That's the E2 Hawkeye.
Hawkeye. So I wanted to mention also, David Beatty was going to be on the show tonight, and he sent me a clip that's going to be, this is kind of an announcement, a new announcement. There's going to be a clip that's going to be put up on YouTube to accompany the clip that's up there now that has over 1 million views, and it's his documentary on this case. People have come forward, including, you know, Jason Turner, who didn't make the show tonight, and yourself, and as well as two other people. One is remaining anonymous, but one of them was up in that plane and actually is saying that they actually did see the objects, visually see the objects. So stay tuned for that. That'll be up on YouTube in a couple of weeks.
Dave Beatty, by the way, was instrumental in getting other witnesses to come forward. And the short video that he did on YouTube is called, for those who are listening that haven't seen it, it's called The Nimitz Encounters. And if you go on to YouTube and you do the search, at least two of them will pop up with that name. But it's the one with, like you said, a 1.4 million views or whatever it is now.
Right. Yeah.
It's about 16, 17 minutes long. And I think his plan is, as more and more witnesses come forward, is to continually update the video and include their testimony in it.
Yeah. Now, how...
And I believe that's going to happen. I believe more and more people are going to come out.
I do, too. But let me ask you this. Did you have any trepidation about coming out with this? I know some people had to sign NDAs, non-disclosures. But did you have... were you told, you know, to keep quiet about this?
Never. I was never told to keep quiet about it. In fact, that the video that came out, that I call it the At Flare video. There's several of them, but it's basically the one with probably the most famous one, where the object screeches off to the left part of your screen in just a nanosecond.
It's just the gimbal. What they call the gimbal.
That video actually arrived in my email like the very morning after this encounter happened. So I had seen that video. That day that this new story broke on CNN, of course, they showed that video, and I'd seen that same video 14 years ago. As soon as I saw this thing happening, I knew instantly in my own mind that I had to speak out. I had to stand up and say, yes, Commander Fravor isn't crazy. This really happened. I was his air controller. It was my team in Princeton that discovered the UAPs, and I'm going to back him up. Now, my only trepidation about coming forward was just what was going to happen to, what was going to happen to me personally with my life. Cause I was going to become a public person all of a sudden. No. And the reason why I decided to do it, I got some good counseling from my cousin, Jack Cook. He was like, Kevin, this really happened. And I think that you need to say something and let the chips fall where they may, man, up. So that's what I decided to do.
Yeah. Well, if something really happened,
I pray to God I made the right decision every day.
Well, I think you did, because if something really happened, then really, what do you have to lose if you're just plain telling the truth? You can't be judged for the truth, really.
I hope not. Yeah.
Well, some people will judge anyway, but as I was talking about earlier, the pseudo skeptics, the people that just say no, this is hogwash, and I know. Let's talk a little bit about that. For instance, I know that there's a lot of people that bring up the, I think it was the gimbal, what they call the gimbal UFO film, the one that came out on, when the Pentagon story came out in December back in 2017. That famous film with millions of views, that started out on a German website that did... Did you know anything about this, hear anything about that the first time it went up on YouTube?
I knew nothing at all about the 2015 gimbal incident. That happened out on the East Coast.
Right, that was in Florida. Right.
Yeah, completely different strike group.
But people are tying it to the Nimitz. Pardon me, we're talking over each other. People are tying that to the Nimitz case. I'm sure you're aware of that.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. And I did run the film on YouTube here just a minute ago of the actual footage. But there were people like Jason, who was going to be on the show tonight, that actually saw the very high definition film that is not available. Do you know other people that actually saw that film as well?
Only through the grapevine, only through rumors. The actual... video that I saw the next day, I think it was probably an MP3 an MPEG. So it wasn't real, it looked pretty similar to what I saw that day on CNN when the news broke. Unfortunately, I never got to see the other video. Apparently there was a much longer one, much higher definition.
Yeah.
But wherever that is now, I have no idea.
Yeah. But it exists. That's the thing. There's probably a lot of there's probably a lot of great film out there that exists. So while this is going on, you're observing all this. Are you just like everyone around you and yourself just shaking your head? What the heck is going on here? I mean, did it feel like it was an invasion of some type, or what was that like?
I'd have to say not at all. I never once had the feeling or the impression in that these things were hostile or in any way interested in us at all, actually. And the reason why I say that is because we intercepted them, and when we were done, they went straight back up into the sky and kept going south as if nothing had happened. I tracked them. I continued to track them. They fell off my radar coverage off the coast of Baja California above a little island down there. I think it's called Isla de Militar or something like that. You could find it easily on the map. Now, I'm not sure. I don't know if they landed there or they just they went out of my radar horizon at that point. But they continued south at 28,000 feet going 100 knots as if nothing at all had happened.
Wow. Now, is it classified the height that the radar will reach to?
Yes, it is. There's different modes of the radar. I was operating in a mode where I couldn't see as high as it can go. Mm-hmm. But I have heard there's some of the watchstanders actually have said publicly now that they saw them come from space down to about 80,000 feet. And then drop down to 20,000s. But the only time the only altitudes I saw the objects myself, what my own eyes, was at 28,000 and below. Wow. I never saw them that high.
Yeah.
But you know, I was in a different, completely different sub mode on my system, so it doesn't surprise me.
Now I know you're not one to speculate, but I'm still going to ask you this question. Why do you suppose there was an object in the water? Have you been thinking about that? Why that was there?
I think it could have been biologics. I mean, because Commander Fravor saw the tic-tac just above the surface, and presumably these things have some sort of propulsion technology behind them. Maybe they attract fish. Maybe the fish were coming up to take a look and just creating a disturbance in the water. There's other theories out there that I can't ascribe myself to them because I just don't know. I would say biologics.
Okay. There was at some point where someone mentioned that they thought that the shape in the water looked almost like, it was vertical, but then it had like a crossbar, almost like, like wings. And then I hadn't heard anything more about that. Did you actually hear of what the object looked like or the disturbance looked like?
Yeah, when I talked to Commander Fravor when we returned back to San Diego, I pulled him off his side and we talked a little bit about this. He described the tic-tacs as they look just like tic-tacs, about 47 feet long, no doors, no windows, no propulsion, just like a giant tic-tac. And I said, well, what about the disturbance in the water? He said, well, it looked to me like an airplane had gone down. It was just right below the surface. So that's probably where that description originated, I would have to think.
Right. Right. Wow. Well, okay. So as this is, go ahead.
To kind of answer your question, we were indeed standing around in combat, looking at each other with big, huge question marks in place of pupils. And I remember asking Captain Smith, I said, well, sir, what do you think these things are? And his response was ice crystals.
Really?
I mean, that just goes to show. He was a very, very experienced skipper, lots of years at sea, lots of years behind radars. And, I mean, I think we were all racking our brains to try to understand what we were looking at.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe his explanation was as good as anyone else's at the moment.
Yeah. When a skipper says something like that, then you just say, oh, okay. I mean, you don't argue with him, right?
I actually kind of laughed out loud, and I thought he was going to get mad at me, but he didn't. He kind of chuckled too. He said, "Well, I actually don't really know, Senior Chief." Kind of let me slide on that one. I normally didn't have the habit of laughing at captains.
Yeah.
When I'm looking at them.
Yeah, yeah.
But I In other words, I didn't think it was ice crystals. I thought that was, if I could say that, I thought it was a ludicrous explanation at the time, but that's okay.
Now,
no one knew what they were.
Right, right. You know, it seems to me, this is just my own thoughts, but it would seem to me that if there was an encounter like this, the military should be curious, you know, because, you know, for instance, the Air Force is supposed to kind of protect the skies. And, you know, I know this is the Navy, Navy operation, but also, you know, Navy is there to protect as well. I would just think that there'd be more curiosity and almost like other arms of the service could get involved and, you know, at least trying to figure out what these things are and trying to do some more tracking. But it just seems like there was no real engagement except for, you know, Commander Fravor's flight going up and checking it out. Really, there was no other engagement of any type, was there?
At the time, I didn't know that there was, but as it turns out, there actually was engagement. Mm-hmm. Apparently, what happened, and again, this is secondhand information to me, not my personal experience, but just talking to some of the other witnesses. Apparently, a couple Air Force officers arrived on board the Nimitz and actually took custody of all the pilot data that was there. And interestingly, on board the Princeton, I came up the next day. I was going to write an after action report about this whole thing, and I was going to decide to listen to the comms, which is recorded to optical disc and multiple tracks. In case something happens, we can go back and listen to the comms and figure it out. The comms were all gone. Someone had taken the comms.
Wow.
I didn't know about it. A lot of the witnesses are claiming they had to sign NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, told not to talk about it, and that's probably a reason why they're not talking about it. Something you take pretty seriously if you're told that. I never was. I transferred, the ship came back into port, I transferred a couple weeks later, and I went to my last assignment in the Navy before I retired. No one at no point, no one ever talked to me about it. No one ever questioned me about it. No, I never had to sign anything. That's why I feel free to do it today. If I would have had to sign an NDA or told not to talk about it, you probably would have never heard my name. I take it that seriously.
Sure. Yeah, I agree. We'll pick this up after the break, but I want to talk to you why it's possible that they didn't even ask you that. So for now, we're going to go to break. So hang in, everyone. We'll be right back right after these messages. That's it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with Suzanne and Scott Ramsey talking about the Aztec UFO crash, which I never really thought there was much to that. But after talking to Dave Marler in detail, I really think there might be something to that. And we have the go-to people on the show coming up to talk about that incident. Again, that's next week. If you want to listen to the full shows, you have about an hour here, but the full shows are close to 2 hours. All you have to do is sign up and support the show for $2 or more a month. You can also make a one-time payment per year. That's all on the website, podcastufo.com, under support the show. And check out our Facebook page, Podcast UFO on Facebook. And that's it. So thanks so much, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.